Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us with film critics Claudia Puig, the president of the LA Film Critics Association, and Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. We begin this week with a brand new movie from Judd Apatow. He not only directs but co-wrote the film with its star Pete Davidson. It's based on incidents in Davidson's own life. Marissa Tomei co-stars in The King of Staten Island. Amy?
Yeah, Judd Apatow's comedy template for the last decade or so has been, you know, pick a rising comic who just has radioactive amounts of talent and take their whole comedy persona and sort of shoehorn it into a semi-autobiographical story where they get to really heal their problems, you know, usually through love, kind of like what he did with Amy Schumer a few years ago in Trainwreck. And it's interesting who he's picked. You know, his star of the new one who helps write it, of course, is Pete Davidson, who people might be able to picture as like the heavily tattooed, skinny guy who became one of SNL's youngest cast in the show when he was 20 years old. And this is his loosely autobiographical story. It's the story of a kid like him, who's kind of a screw up, whose dad is a firefighter who died when he was young, and who is, you know, battling with some mental health challenges, and he's scared of himself. He doesn't think that he's completely stable, and he smokes too much weed, and he's a giant screw-up. And so this is a movie kind of about who he would be if he hadn't fallen into comedy, if he hadn't, you know, set sort of a template of his own by being one of the youngest members of Saturday Night Live when he was 20 years old. And it's interesting because you can feel kind of a tension in this film. You know, Judd Apatow wants to make this a happy ending. You know, he wants to like have him mature and grow up and put this kind of sweet, sugary spin on things. But Pete Davidson is kind of a better comedian than that. I mean, this is really a great selling point movie for Pete Davidson as a leading man. I mean, he's really charismatic. He's really funny. And he's not a comedian that I think can get shoehorned into an easy answer, happy kind of comedy the way that Judd Apatow wants to do. And so there's a really kind of fascinating push-pull in the center of this, where Pete Davidson almost breaks out of the Judd Apatow template and makes a movie that feels interesting on its own.
The King of Staten Island, new film we're talking about. Claudia, what did you think?
Well, I agree with Amy. I think Pete Davidson is very charismatic. And he also has this kind of sweetness and vulnerability along with kind of this edginess and even, a tad of like something obnoxious but sort of likable. So he's appealing. And he has this very expressive face. And, you know, we have known about his public persona and his pain and his emotional trauma. So I think that helps in some way inform this film, but I feel like in some ways it's kind of light, and it kind of, you know, struggles to become a bromance, and I feel like it's not terribly effective in that way. But I think, you know, I think Amy brings up a really good point. I think that maybe he doesn't fit into this structure in the same way that Seth Rogen or some of the other people that Judd Apatow has worked with to sort of fit into this template. And I don't feel like this is like lightning in a bottle magic that some of his other films have been. You know, they've been kind of cultural touchstones like this 40-Year-Old Virgin. But I don't feel like it's as good as Funny People, which is maybe one of his more nuanced and complex films. But it's enjoyable. It's a little too long. It's 135 minutes. That's too long. There's some other good performances, but it's, you know, it does certainly show that Pete Davidson can be a star.
We're talking about the comedic drama The King of Staten Island, starring Pete Davidson, who co-wrote it with the director Judd Apatow. The film's rated R, and you can see it in just about every on-demand platform imaginable. Defy Bloods is the new Spike Lee film. Lee co-wrote it, directed it. Delroy Lindo, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. star. Claudia.
Well, this movie could not be more timely and relevant. It feels almost prophetic coming, as it is right now in the midst of the uprisings that are going on and, you know, post-George Floyd's killing. So it's landed at the perfect time. And many of us are expressly looking for films about the Black experience, just as we're looking for, you know, things to read about the Black experience. So this, you know, navigates this inflection point. And, you know, it also deals with systemic racism, but it is a look at the Vietnam War from a Black perspective. And, you know, in the way that Spike Lee can kind of bring in the past and give you kind of a history lesson in an entertaining way. I think it succeeds that way. And he brings up the fact that only 11% of the U.S. population are African American, but in Vietnam they represented 33% of the troops. So that right there is, you know, one inequity. And then I think it's then he goes into this story. It's kind of it flashes back and forward. We see these four guys who had been brothers together in Vietnam, and they go back to reclaim their commander's remains and also to find a treasure that they consider sort of reparations. It's a continuing reminder that he's a really vital filmmaker, and it's a strong follow-up to Black Klansman, which won the Best Adapted Screenplay last year, 2019. I like that it's illuminating, fascinating. It's not didactic. There's some fantastic performances. Delroy Lindo is excellent. Chadwick Boseman and Jonathan Majors, who is in Last Black Man in San Francisco as Delroy Lindo's son. And it covers so many issues that are black trauma, police violence, American imperialism. They have some references to Donald Trump as the president of fake bone spurs, and a MAGA hat is kind of a quasi-cursed talisman. So it's very timely.
To Five Bloods from Spike Lee, Amy.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating film. It's almost more interesting to talk about after the fact than it is to watch it, if that makes sense. Because when you watch it from scene to scene, it's a film that has so much of the Spike Lee energy that it doesn't really feel like it coheres from scene to scene. And it kind of shifts from a comedy to, you know, very strongly hat-tipping itself to films like Treasure of the Sierra Madre, to Apocalypse Now, you know, to the point where a character says, you know, to the camera, you know, madness, madness. And, you know, watching it, I was sort of a little befuddled and trying to put it all together into a coherent story. And then when you take a step back, you know, it really feels like this is a film where Spike Lee is being so obvious in the films that he's making, tipping his hat to, that it passes through homage and turns almost into a statement about ownership. You know, saying this is my epic, this is my version of Apocalypse Now, and why haven't we had the black experience told in its version of Apocalypse Now in the past? And it feels kind of like reclaiming almost Hollywood myths in the way. Like, he's very detailed. There's even a character played by Jean Reno who shows up dressed like Belloc from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so it feels like within this story that, you know, teeters from Wild Hogs to Apocalypse Now, you're also talking about the legacy of the stories that have been put onto film and kind of putting your own stamp on that. And I have to absolutely agree with Claudia. Delroy Lindo is fascinating. I mean, he's really, he's just so compelling in this. He gives a few monologues straight to camera where you almost can't breathe because it's so tense and scary and powerful.
He's always a powerful presence, whether it's film or television. We're talking about, charisma, Pete Davidson in the last film. Lindo, to me, is one of those actors who he has so much presence on screen.
Absolutely.
And you know, what's interesting, too, about the way that Spike Lee does it is he gives you extra Delroy Lindo, because even though this film does take place in the past a lot, he uses the same actors, the older actors, in the flashbacks. So they're just showing up as their older versions of themselves, reliving their past. And I think there's interesting things to pull apart in how you don't get to move forward, how you're kind of the same person you are. But also, it is true that Delroy Lindo is so compelling in this film that the other characters fall to the side a bit.
To Five Bloods from director and co-screenwriter Spike Lee, Delroy Lindo, Clark Peters, Norm Lewis, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. star. The film's rated R, and it's streaming on Netflix. The family fantasy adventure Artemis Fowl stars Ferdia Shaw, Lara McDonald, and Josh Gad. Kenneth Branagh directs the film. Connor McPherson and Hamish McCall are the screenwriters. Amy?
Yeah, this is just another gigantic, focus tested to death, splashy kids special effects movie that just feels like very test marketed to death and very weak and kind of a flop. The story here is that Artemis Fowl is a genius, and his father, played by Colin Farrell, is kind of a historian and also possibly a criminal, and he disappears. And as Artemis is a kid, his dad is always telling him about the history of goblins and dwarves and fairies. He's a magical expert and sort of an Irish historian of fantasy as well. And so he's trained his super genius kid to know everything about this underground fairy magical world. And then his dad is himself kidnapped. And Artemis Fowl has to do one of those boring old stories where he has to find a magical doohickey to save the planet and everybody's running after to get the magical doohickey back. I mean, it's a strange movie because what's happening in the fairy underground is that you have all these like fairy policemen. Judi Dench is the chief of the fairy cops. There's a younger kid who's also like a fairy cop that Artemis Fowl has to deal with. I mean, it's almost like if Harry Potter was about policemen. And it's just, I mean, it's weird. It feels like the longest movie on earth because you don't go anywhere. Most of the action just takes place inside of Artemis Fowl's magical house. And then it's told with this narration flashback from Josh Gad as this tall dwarf who wishes he was shorter, who's been arrested by the police at the very beginning. It's almost like they're trying to do, you know, a Kaiser Soze kind of flashback with Josh Gad. I mean, I guess if you have kids, this will kill 90 minutes. It's very hard to sit through. it's wild to me that there's films that supposedly have all this imagination and yet feel just as trite and rote as everything else in the Disney canon lately.
Artemis Fowl is streaming on Disney Plus. It's rated PG, based on the novel by Owen Colfer. Artemis Fowl, Kenneth Branagh, the director. The Surrogate, a drama, stars Jasmine Batchelor, Chris Perfetti, and Sullivan Jones. It's written and directed by Jeremy Hirsch in a feature writing and directing debut. Claudia, what'd you think of The Surrogate?
I like this film. It's a small, kind of micro-budgeted film, and it's really all about the performance of Jasmine Batchelor as Jess, and it's just wonderfully anchored by her performance. It's very naturalistic. The film is about a woman who agrees to be a surrogate for her best friend, who is gay, and his husband, and then a prenatal test comes back, and the results are unexpected, and it kind of brings up some moral dilemmas for all involved, and particularly for the woman who is the surrogate. So she goes through, you know, every possibility, thinking about the best course of action, and she really goes through it thoroughly, and I love that it's never moralistic. It just looks at all the angles and all the ramifications of a pregnancy where you learn there could be unexpected conditions. There's no histrionics. There's no preaching. It's perceptive. It's absorbing. You know, there are no easy answers here, no easy right or wrong answers, and they don't try to make it easy. And it kind of surprises you along the way, which is great. And she is this kind of person who's always trying to please, and which is probably why she agrees to do it in the first place. Not that many people might. But, you know, because she is this accommodating person, you sort of see how she evolves into somebody who is more herself and kind of comes into her own. And she just has this lived-in performance that's great. The whole, I think the ensemble cast is really good. You see her growth as a character. I just love the unexpected directions and the lack of easy answers about this film. I think it's really quite good.
The Surrogate, the film Claudia is telling us about. Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, it is absolutely a terrific debut from Jeremy Hirsch. And Jasmine Batchelor, who plays the lead, is fantastic. I mean, this character is a really interesting portrait of the kind of optimistic do-gooding that can wind up causing a lot of problems as well. You know, Jess is so interesting. She's a person who shows up with the reusable water bottle. She's got the job at the nonprofit. And her selflessness does also come with kind of a self-righteous streak. You know, she's very idealistic and expects a lot out of people and expects a lot of herself. I like movies like this where everyone involved is a good person and they're attempting to be a good communicator. And when you listen to the way they talk to each other, you know, there's more apologies for inadvertent microaggressions than there are like arguments between the characters. They're all trying to work this out. And it's also worth noting that Jess is upper middle class and she's black, and that factors into when she has difficult conversations with her mother. You know, they have a really tricky conversation about her family raised her to break stereotypes about single motherhood. And so that adds this whole other dimension to the film, if it comes to single motherhood. So I really appreciate this film. And you also do have some, you get to spend some time with some Down syndrome children here as actors, including a really adorable boy named Leon, who just is the cutest thing on the planet.
All right. The film is The Surrogate, starring Jasmine Batchelor. It's directed and written by Jeremy Hirsch. The film's unrated. It's available on Vimeo, the on-demand platform, as well as Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema. It's unrated. Coming up, we'll hear about Sometimes, Always, Never and the short history of The Long Road. It's Film Week on KPCC. Great to have you with us for Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, kpcc.org, and of course, it's a podcast and a highly popular one. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Film Week. I'm joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson of The Guardian and the podcast Unspooled, and Claudia Puig, who's the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association. Our next film up is a British comedic drama, Sometimes, Always, Never. It's directed by Carl Hunter. Frank Cottrell Boyce is the screenwriter, and it stars Bill Nighy, Sam Riley, and Alice Lowe. Amy, Sometimes, Always, Never.
Yeah, this is a really jewel box indie dramedy portrait of a father and a son. One of those kind of comedies that teeters right on the edge of being dark and irredeemable and bitter and funny. The story here is that Bill Nighy and his son, Sam Riley, are really grappling with the fact that Sam Riley's brother, Bill Nighy's son, has disappeared, and they don't know what happened to him, and they're trying to find him. And the film opens with them going on this tiny road trip of sorts to see a body that's been found and discover if it's theirs. The way it is about how these two people really aren't processing their emotions and communicating, and the way that they do communicate is through Scrabble. So this film is incredibly Scrabble obsessed, and if you are looking for a film that interjects stories about fathers and sons with debates about whether XI is a letter or a word, you know, the words like music that just keep coming up with gigantic high Scrabble counts. And kind of the drama is that, you know, here are people who are so good with words and good at using them and summing them up, but they are not able to talk at all. And they tend to disappear when things get uncomfortable. And these men of the family are all trying to use their intelligence as a way to dominate conversations and win over people and win over women. And you know, it's an enjoyable film. It feels kind of slight in action, but Bill Nighy himself, I mean, he's so good at skating on that edge of being a person that you hate as much as you want him to like you. And that's happening very strongly here.
Sometimes, Always, Never, Claudia.
Yeah, I think Alan is his character. Bill Nighy's character, he's the only person that could ever play this role. I mean, you believe him as this dapper tailor. You know, he is acerbic, but he's also, you feel his dignity underlying and also his regret and his grief. Because there's a lot of, you know, while there is the whole Scrabble thing, and I learned some new words, which I'm very happy about. And, you know, you have the sort of offbeat aspects. You also have this underlying undercurrent of heartache and grief and healing. And but there's at the same time, you have this visual cuteness that sort of feels like an Anglo-Saxon Amelie with a touch of Wes Anderson sort of sprinkled in. There's this, you know, vivid, eye-catching, very color-drenched style. And then there's these sort of stylized chapters, you know, that we've seen before, and conversations that are kind of filmed through archways, and then, you know, painted backdrops. So it has a stylized kind of low-key eccentricity. And, of course, Bill Nighy also sort of embodies sort of British low-key eccentricity. So, you know, that all works. And even the premise is sort of offbeat. I mean, they were all playing Scrabble, and the two sons and the father argued over the legitimacy of the word "zo," you know, which is very boring in Scrabble, and the son stormed off and never came back. So, you know, there's an offbeat aspect, but also a lot more depth there. And again, Nighy is just fantastic as this controlling and kind of bitingly witty guy who also, you know, kind of uses words to hide behind and also to sort of control, but at the same time you see sort of his emotions come through. And the rest of the performances are also really quite good. I mean, it's Bill Nighy's movie, but Sam Riley, who plays the son, has a lot more notes than just kind of the son that is still around. You know, he could just play, it could have been a one-note resentful kind of son, and it's more than that. So I think the script is also something to to note. And then Jenny Agutter, it's nice to see her come back, and Tim McInerney have smaller parts. And I think it works. I mean, it's slight, but it's you know, it, particularly for people who enjoy British, you know, drama comedies. And how can you not love Bill Nye?
Sometimes, Always, Never, directed by Carl Hunter, Frank Cottrell Boyce wrote the screenplay. It's rated PG-13, Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema to see the film. The short history of The Long Road, a drama starring Sabrina Carpenter, Stephen Ogg, and Danny Trejo. It's written and directed by Ani Simon Kennedy. Claudia?
Well, this is a little gem of a movie. It's played a lot of film festivals, and I think it won a special jury award at Tribeca a couple years ago, 2019. I guess that would be just last year. And it's a kind of a simple story about a teenager who grows up with her father living out of a van, basically. They're like these nomadic father and daughter, and not because he is a loser, but more because this is kind of his philosophical approach to life, and he thinks that, it's not really kind of homelessness. It's more like this is what the life he wants to have, a life on the open road, and so they crisscross the United States, and he feels like he's giving her the best possible education. She goes to libraries. He makes ends meet by being a kind of a fix-it guy, a handyman, and he relishes their independence. I'm not sure she relishes it quite as much, but something happens, and their rootlessness something changes everything. I don't want to give it too much away. But suddenly she is kind of cast onto her own, and so I wish it had explored homelessness a little bit more and what it's like to be sort of a teenager in this situation. It didn't quite do that. There's some wonderful lines, though, like the father will say things after he fixes somebody's sink. He'll say, you know, humans are a migratory species, and we're going back to our roots, and society will be, you know, better off once we build an army of self-sufficient agitators. And, you know, he's very anti-TV. He tells her to look out her window, and she has, you know, it's like a TV screen there. So I think there's some really nice moments. It's a coming-of-age film, and then it has this great performance by Danny Trejo, who's runs a garage, and they kind of bond. And then a Native American actress named Joshuan St. John, who's also quite good. And Stephen Ogg, who plays the father, is excellent. He reminds me a little bit of kind of Peter Fonda. Maybe it's because he's on the open road, but Sabrina Carpenter as the lead actress is quite good. It's a very nice little small movie that has something to say about coming of age and about, you know, how you can educate yourself in ways other than the traditional schooling.
The short history of The Long Road, a drama written and directed by Ani Simon Kennedy in her feature directing debut. The movie's unrated. It's available starting Tuesday of next week on iTunes. Infamous stars Bella Thorne and Jake Manley. It's written and directed by Joshua Caldwell, a crime drama. Amy?
Yeah, this is the kind of movie we get every generation or so. It's the Bonnie and Clyde of this generation. We've actually already had a few of them recently this year. You know, we had Queen and Slim last year, and this is the Instagram version of that, where Instagram is to blame for everything. The story here is that Bella Thorne is from what she calls the Redneck Riviera of Florida, and she's this bored and beautiful and heavily tattooed girl who just wants to be famous, and she's from a family with really zero options. You know, her mom's not really there, and her mom just rotates in a series of bad boyfriends, one in particular, who's there. And so when she sees this kind of blonde bad boy mechanic played by Jake Manley who shows up in town, she seizes on this. She's like, we need to leave town. We are going to support ourselves robbing weed dispensaries as we make our way to California. And she wants to get famous. And she tries to convince him that if she Instagrams all of their robberies, that's great. And he is a little bit more logical. He's sensible, if you can be a sensible robber, and a sensible ex-con saying, you know, this is a terrible idea. The cops are going to get us. And that's pretty much the argument of the film, you know. It's interesting. You know, we keep getting these stories of, like, thrill-seeking young lovers, and they don't really change as much as they just reflect what we think is the problem with the kids these days. And so here it feels like, you know, it's a very thin fable in that the lesson's obvious from the beginning. You know, getting online fame means nothing compared to your life if you're not standing for something in particular. But yet, you know, as much as I rolled my eyes at a lot of these films, I do have to say, you know, Bella Thorne is very committed to the part, and I like her in the part. And I really think that Jake Manley has an integrity to this film that makes it a stronger film than I think it had to be. You know, he has this bleached hair and stubble. He kind of looks like a 90s Brad Pitt style, you know, that kind of dirty, greasy, shocking look. And so I appreciate this film more than I thought. It was revolutionary at all.
We're talking about the drama, crime drama, Infamous, Claudia.
Yeah, I would say it definitely wasn't revolutionary. You know, it's so true. We have Bonnie and Clyde, Natural Born Killers. But I feel like this isn't not nearly as thought-provoking. And then Amy mentioned Queen and Slim, which I thought was exploring far more intriguing territory. In contrast to, you know, a movie like The Five Bloods, this could, you know, which is so perfectly timed, this feels off timing-wise. Not only is it a thin story, but it's trying to make this statement about social media and young people's obsession with it and empty-headed teens. But we're actually at a time right now where young people are using their voice for positive change. And so I feel like the timing is really off. It doesn't feel like it's of this moment. It's coming off as a kind of this lightweight indictment of a generation that kind of does care about things. I mean, they do care about equality and climate change. And so, you know, yes, there are certainly plenty of people who probably care about mindless likes and followers. And, you know, they eventually get millions of people following them in their crime escapade, but it feels like a little too little too late in terms of a commentary. But I do agree that Bella Thorne is very committed to the part, and Jake Manley, who's named Dean, and he's playing kind of a James Dean role, you know, he does a good job. He is a sort of bleach blonde guy who seems to have a jot more sense than she does. But, you know, we know no good is ever going to come of it. As we're watching, we know that eventually they're either going to be caught or, you know, they're going to be killed, one or the other. We know that they're not just going to get away with this. They're not particularly likable. They're not all that well-developed. I think performances are as good as they can possibly be, given the limitations of the script.
Infamous is the film, Bella Thorne, Jake Manley. It's unrated, and it's at drive-ins. You can actually see it at a theater, including the Mission Tiki, the Vineland, and the Van Buren. And it's available for at-home viewing on iTunes, Google Play, Vudu, and Fandango now. Infamous is unrated. 2 Minutes of Fame, a comedy starring Jay Farrow and Cat Williams, Leslie Small directed, Devon Shepard and Yamara Taylor are the screenwriters. Amy?
Yeah, we actually have two comedies this week starring SNL people. This one here is starring Jay Farrow as a young comedian, aspiring comedian, really, who's working at a grocery store and wants to leave Birmingham, Alabama, where he has a wife and a kid, for this comedy contest in Los Angeles with his best friend, who's sort of his mentor. And there's a few competing forces happening here. You know, one, this is a story about, like, people who have made it and haven't made it. You know, he's competing online, making mean videos about a major black comedian who's played by Cat Williams, who he thinks has sold out a lot. He makes films where he, for example, plays a black crow. And so there's this internet war between the two of them. You know, Jay making videos about how Cat Williams' comedies are a disgrace, Cat Williams fighting back and saying, like, you're just an Instagram comedian. You don't even know the training that people like me went through. You weren't there in the 90s working your way up, getting mentorship. And I think that dynamic is pretty interesting. And I think Jay Farrow himself, I mean, he's a terrific mimic. I mean, he does impressions all the way throughout this film. Tracy Morgan, Kevin Hart, Jay-Z, Eddie Murphy, Obama. They are amazing impressions. But yet the character himself that he's playing is kind of the worst. You know, Kiki Palmer is his wife. And everything she says about, like, what are you doing? You're half on her side. And when he – the kind of comedy he writes, the kind of comedy he performs is not that great. And so it's hard to root for this guy to succeed. I think the film, you know, sets up a lot of interesting questions and then just kind of softballs it with a happy ending.
2 Minutes of Fame, comedy starring Jay Farrow and Cat Williams. Leslie Small directs. It's rated R and available starting next Tuesday, streaming on iTunes. And we've got just about a minute or so to talk about the French drama Aviva, the film written and directed by Boaz Yakin. Claudia, what'd you think?
Well, I think it's intriguing. It's somewhat flawed, but I think it's a fluid movie in a lot of ways, fluid in body movements, fluid in its definition of gender and love. It's a dance movie, and it's sexy, and it's often daring. There's a lot of it's impressionistic, and it's the gender fluidity is probably the most interesting aspect. These two characters who fall in love, and they're played by four different people, and it alternates between male and female actors playing them. So it's trying to capture the complexity of relationships and of and the fluidity of genders. And there's some beautiful dance sequences. It's choreography from a former member of the Israeli dance company, Bat Shiva Dance Company. So I think there's some. I feel like the love story is not nearly as interesting. I feel like it's more pedestrian, but the dance and of course the exploration of gender is more intriguing.
Aviva is the film starring Bobby Janae Smith, written and directed by Boaz Yakin. It's unrated. It's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema and the Frida Virtual Cinema. Coming up, The Frame's John Horn interviews writer, director, producer Judd Apatow. They'll be talking about the new film, The King of Staten Island, a film that brings to the forefront Saturday Night Live performer Pete Davidson. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC.